Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I'd buy.
Hello and welcome back to Sykes and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Andrew on the board. We have a beautiful. Do we have a beautiful Wednesday here? What do we have? We have a kind of a crummy Wednesday, don't we, Andrew? Just saying. Did you watch the Scooter Coffee Bowl last night? You ever heard of Scooter Coffee?
No, that is completely new to me.
We have Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
Well, I'm doing all right.
Were you off to get your Scooter Coffee this morning since you watched the bowl last night and they sponsored it?
I neither watched the bowl. Nor have I heard of Scooter Coffee.
S&P futures up 15, NASDAQ futures up 48. We have the Fed announcement today. We were down yesterday. Of course, we got to be up today. That's the way the market is. We are pouring stuff in. You never guess what I found, Kevin, as I was cleaning my place. Not only did I find the original Joe Granville technical analysis book, that one of these days I got to dig through and remind myself how much I forgot of my calculus. We also found like 7 or 8 of selected papers by George Stigler. I started reading those last night. Boy, are they're something. Talking about reformers, talking about, but this is kind of right up your alley, because
let's make sure all of our listeners know George Stigler, Nobel award winning University of Chicago professor,
and a real character. I had him for two classes. And he was funny as all get out, but he was a behavioral economist, and he was big buddies with Milton Friedman. Well, they would argue all the time, but they were big buddies. But he was talking about the monetary history of the United States, and here's one of the comments. He goes, "The stock of money shows larger fluctuations after 1914 than before 1914, and this is true even if the large wartime increases in the stock of money are excluded. The blind, undesigned, and quasi-automatic working of the gold standard turned out to produce a greater measure of predictability and regularity than did deliberate and conscious control exercise within institutional arrangements intended to promote monetary stability." And he goes, "Many economists and all bankers will challenge Friedman's conclusions." He goes, "In fact, a fair number will challenge him even before they learn what he has written." Which is obviously very true, right? I mean, that hasn't changed. But no one will be able in good conscience to say that Friedman's study was anticipated or been contradicted by any other study of comparable scope and thoroughness. Andrew's going to get coffee here. I forgot to give him the card to get back in the building. He'd be out on the street. I really don't want poor Andrew out on the street. But it is interesting. People will contradict it before they even read.
Taking some dead air time, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, we're good. But he's got us on autopilot. But isn't that amazing, though? People will contradict it before they even read it. The world has not changed much, has it?
It has not, and I guess a certain amount of predictability in the world isn't a bad thing.
I guess. I have to ask, after going through what we went through in the 70s and 80s. I know I talk about this all the time, probably the point of people saying, why is he saying this again? But I am curious, Kevin, we went through all that, and the idea was nobody knew what was happening, why there was inflation. And we just had this huge work by some guy that he really should have won the Nobel Prize for that. He ended up winning for something else, Friedman. But really, it was for the monetary history of the United States, because I mean, nobody ever did work like that before. And so he comes up with all these conclusions that are right there. I mean, they're so obvious if you read it that they're not even... So hence this monetary school was born, and now we have 40-some years later another inflation problem, and it's the exact same thing. And yet all these people that supposedly have gone to school and learned economics, if you're on CNBC or Fox Business, if you say something about the money supply, they get the hook. Why is something that's so...
I usually get a little bit of Maria Bartiromo show on the before we come on, and people do talk a lot about the money supply on that show.
Maybe, okay, I don't... Because, I mean, at CNBC, they don't want anybody talking about it.
Okay.
And well, you're right. They have a couple guys who will come on, but when they say it, the announcers, they just glaze over. They don't even know what they're talking about. But how is it just not so simple that if you double the amount of money, all the prices are going to double? I mean, why is this?
It's not. It shouldn't be controversial, but do keep in mind that a lot of people who go to economics school now are exposed to modern monetary theory.
Which is what?
Which is basically none of the spending matters. I suppose it's, you know, when its sole credibility is wrapped up in it uses the word modern, that's kind of meaningless, isn't it?
Remember new math?
Yeah, yes, it's the new math. So yeah, it's a different version of the same concept, the idea that there's different ways to do it. And, you know, math is kind of one of those really, really steady, you know, items, articles of truth.
Yeah.
I think that it's a lot of the problem is that people are exposed to monetary theory that just it's true because somebody says it's true, not because it's proven true.
Well, the new theory regarding deficits and so forth, and it's really not all that new. I mean, when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. The idea is, okay, we've got governmental debt, and we're sort of just like a company. We're never going to retire the debt. We just have it, okay? But when we come up with a spending plan, I think this is the whole logic to the thing, but it falls apart, and it falls apart. Well, I'll explain why I think it falls apart. The idea is if you do something and you spend money, okay, or you cut taxes, or you increase, whatever you do, the idea is we owe, you know, $1 trillion. Of course, we owe a lot more than that, but say we owe $1 trillion. That over the next 10 years, if you come up with a plan, that even if it increases spending in the meantime, at the end of 10 years, if the growth in the economy is 3% and the growth in the debt is 2.9%, you're gaining on it. Correct? And if you extend that out 100 years, you're going to be progressing the whole way, and eventually you'll get there. You're not going to get there this year. We all know that. It's a question of trend. And I don't think you could really argue that all that much. However, just in the last two administrations, and we have another administration coming in, which is... I don't think... I'm with you, Kevin. I don't think it's going to be the same as Trump 1. I think Trump 2 is going to be a lot different and probably a lot better. I really do believe that. I hope maybe you've talked me into it.
More cohesive. We'll see if it's better or not, but it will be more cohesive.
But so the idea is, okay, Trump cuts taxes. Or Trump's administration puts through a tax cut. The idea is this is actually going to be... We're doing it in such a way where it's going to be accretive to the economy. And because of the way we're cutting them, we're going to become more efficient. More people are going to start businesses because they see that the tax burden from the government's less, so they're going to be willing to invest. And at the end of 10 years, this is going to be accretive. It's going to cause growth to be 4% or 3%, even though we know we're increasing the deficit by 2% or the debt by 2%. Problem is, it was flat-ass wrong. And then the next administration comes in. Well, guess what? We're going to spend all this dough on infrastructure, which, by the way, we probably needed some. I mean, I'm not saying either one of them were totally crazy. But the idea is, oh, no, everybody in in a bad neighborhood now is going to have 5G, and they're all going to get a job. And by the way, everybody's going to start paying taxes. And even though we're spending $1.5 trillion on this, and we don't even know where the money's going, at the end of the day, our return is going to be $1.6 trillion, and it's going to be accretive. Okay, and under the new monetary theory or new budgetary theory, that's fine. It's going to cause the growth rate to go from 2 to 2.5, and our increase in debt is going to be 2%. So we're 0.5% ahead of it because of this bill. And guess what? All will be fine 30 years from now. The fact is, it was all BS, as was the tax cut. So,
here's the things. First of all, I don't think they're going. I don't think that, you know, Trump has talked about doing another tax cut. I don't think that's going to happen. I do think they will be able to push through a reconciliation bill at some point that renews the tax cuts that they put in this first term. So, I think status quo is probably where we're going to wind up on tax cuts.
Well, if they don't.
Whether you like that or not is another discussion, but that's what I think is going to happen. But going back to your original comment, you know, what the theory is, it really works sort of like it would for a business that gets itself into a lot of debt. If right. you have a positive cash flow, whether it's whether you call it your straight up cash flow, your EBITDA, whatever it is, as long as you are churning more cash in than you have cash out, yes. That it's what you described, 3% versus 2.9%, you'll start whacking away at the debt. The problem is that it's not a positive cash flow. It continues to make the debt worse. And so, going back to the business world, if you get yourself in a point where you just don't have the money to pay your creditors, then you go to bankruptcy court, you could do a reorganization, you'll get the reorganization if you do have a positive cash flow, and at some point you'll come out of that and you'll be okay. We don't have any such thing for the government, so that's a problem. And I had a finance professor when I was in graduate school, and at least once every class he kept his money on a money clip, and at least once every class, he would reach in his pocket, he would raise up the money clip in the air, and he would say, "This is all that matters. If you have cash, you're okay. If you don't have cash, you don't have any options." We're kind of in that don't have any options part, because, our only option left, and the one we keep exercising, is to just make, create more money, and we can't afford to keep doing that.
Well,
it's crashing down on us now because it's such a negative cash flow, and we can't afford to we can't afford just the service on the debt.
Okay, be careful, because they're separate things. All the really bright guys we have on the show, you got to be careful. Creating debt is not the same as creating money. You create money because you don't want to create more debt. Correct.
So how do we create the money?
What I'm saying is, herein lies the rub. Two guys run for president or for mayor or for dog catcher or whatever it is. In a democratic society, the two people are essentially auditioning. Now, president's different because you got foreign stuff, you got all that kind of crap. But let's say you and I are running for mayor of, what's the name of your town? Whatever.
Mayor of Onthwa Township.
Yeah, mayor of whatever, the township.
We'll go with king.
Yeah, we'll go with king.
Grand High Exalted Mystic Ruler.
So if we're running, we're essentially interviewing in front of the populace of saying who can run the more efficient government. We both know we need a policeman, we need a fireman, we need all that kind of stuff. And we're going to say we can provide you all these services. I can provide you with all these services at X amount of taxes. Then you say, wait a minute, maybe we don't need all those services. We don't need this, and this. Or maybe we need more, whatever side of it you are. And you say, and this is what my tax base is going to be. And people vote and they decide who's going to manage the place. Okay, now, and that's fine. That's democracy. That makes sense. But if all of a sudden one of us gets in there and starts borrowing a bunch of dough and doesn't tell anybody, and I'm languishing parks and everything else on people, and they find out they're up there, they're behind in debt. Well, that's kind of not fair. So, but a federal government, if they decide they're going to either spend more or tax less, they can only do it one of three ways. One is they have to borrow money. Okay, right? They go out and they borrow it. Or I mean, if they want to spend, they have to do one of two things. They got to borrow it, they got to tax for it, or they can print it, which is what you're... That's why governments went on the gold standard forever. It was a discipline against government doing choice number three. And now all we're doing is choice number three. The COVID situation, if they were going to go and hack for, let's say, $1 trillion a year, which they did, right? If they went out and borrowed that money, it would not have been inflationary at all. Correct? Because they borrowed it or they raised
Tom, why do we keep running up debt? Why do we need to keep coming up?
But I'm saying we keep running up. We're not running up enough. That's the point I'm trying to make that I never seem to get across. We're running up debt, but if we didn't print any more money, the debt would be going up even twice as fast. The Fed poured $3 trillion into the economy. That should have been taxed from people. That's the key difference that virtually everybody on TV misses. The increasing spending only hurts.
But here's my question then. When you say they print it, how does that work?
Because
when I look at printing money, don't you have to issue some kind of note in exchange
when
for the
when cash? When the Federal Reserve goes out and buys a government bond, the check clears. It goes on their balance sheet, but the check clears. It's the same as running off $500 bills and going out and hand them to you. They create money.
They create money, but do they not? Is there not a security involved in
no.
that?
No. Well, it's the security is now on their balance sheet. They went out and bought a $100,000 U.S. bond.
Okay. So we're quibbling over, over the...
Well, Carl will say they create the credit for other people. The bottom line is they put the money in the system that wasn't there before.
I agree with that, yeah. I totally agree with that. But there is some kind of note that goes with it.
If you sold them the bond, the 100 grand...
Even if they hold the credit themselves.
No, there's that's the point. If they buy the bond from Kevin O'Neill... The 100 grand shows up in Kevin O'Neill's bank account. It clears. The bond is now in the Federal Reserve balance sheet, and the money's created. It's the same as if they ran off however many $100 bills that would be handed them to you.
Where I'm struggling with this is. It has to be secure. There's an offsetting account. There's a debit and a credit for everything.
There is. I mean, how would exactly? But that's essentially what they're doing. Is they're pouring money into the system by writing checks that clear that there's nothing behind it. They just clear.
Well, you can't have double entry accounting like that.
I don't think the Fed has to.
I think they got to do something there.
Well, how it actually where that what bank draw that comes from or something, that I'd love to find out the nuts and bolts on that. Maybe Carl will know on Friday or something. But the bottom line is they create the dough. In the Civil War, they actually printed them. They printed greenbacks. That's what they did.
Okay. It's still got to come from somewhere.
Carl says what they do is they issue credit, and the credit ends up being the money. They don't actually print it; they issue credit. That the credit works. That it's a debt.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking is happening here.
But the result is the same.
Yeah, I would agree with you that the result is the same. But again, if there is any kind of a note that goes with that, sooner or later, it's got to come off the books. Do we do it with a perpetual term on it?
I'm gonna do some.
Or is there an expiration date when you have to renew it?
No, I'm gonna dig into the absolute nuts and bolts. It all happens out of the New York Fed. But they essentially, the bottom line is, they go out and they. I mean, how do you think the balance sheet got from $1 trillion to $5 trillion in 9 months or whatever it was?
I think we're arguing over the mechanics.
Yeah, we're arguing over the mechanics. And you know what? I would love to have. I would love to have somebody.
I agree with you that it's the same result. There's a bunch of money in the money supply now that wasn't there before.
It's the same as if, you know, you were a buddy of Caesar's, and you walked in and said, "Hey, Julius, I'm having a rough month. Blah blah blah. The wife's sick. Blah 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 blah. I really could use ten denariuses." And he walks in the back room and whips off 10 of them and hands them to you. It seems trivial. There's 10 denariuses in a city of how many people used to live in Rome. So you do that often enough, and all of a sudden, hey, where'd all this money come from? All of a sudden the prices are up. Same thing. In order to understand what happens, you really have to go down to the basics of it. And the basic paper of that is the root of all this stuff, basically, is the guy who wrote the article on cigarettes in concentration camps. And how they were the medium of exchange. And as soon as the U.S. got there and rescued the people there, the first thing they did was dump a whole bunch of cigarettes on the place. Well, they there went your entire system, because everybody had nothing but cigarettes.
I'm pretty sure it was chocolate that was the currency, and that Sergeant Schultz was the guy who got bribed all the time.
They probably didn't want to use cigarettes out of the air, but or he just liked chocolate. That could be.
Yeah, well, think of Sergeant Schultz. Of course, he got bribed by China.
Wasn't he an immigrant from Germany? He got out of there because he hated the Nazis.
Yeah, I think he was, and a lot of those guys were. There were a lot of Jewish refugees on that.
Was it Klink one of those?
In that cast, Klink, yes. What do you call him? The secret police guy.
Who was the dude that was the general? The guy had the big fat head.
Burkhalter, yeah. I can't remember about him. The guy who played Hochstetter was definitely a refugee, and they all did interviews at the time about how they felt about playing Nazis, and generally they said it was not an easy decision for them. But that what they did like about it was just making fun of them, which is really an odd premise for a show when you think about it. How wacky those Nazis could be.
Well, I mean, you don't when you think back at some of these old movies and stuff after the war, some of the people that were actors and actresses, their history was these things are being filmed in the 50s. That's like two COVIDs ago. It's not that long ago for those people. I mean, some of the people in some of the John Wayne movies. Remember the guy? The hell was it? He had the three cavalry ones. She wore a rail ribbon, and what was the hell was the other? Well, there was a guy who wore the eye patch. He was one of the. He was just a bit actor, and he wore the eye patch. Evidently, he lost his eye in the war. The guy had a gazillion medals. He was like one of those decorated guys in the war. David Niven was an incredible. He went back after he was an actor. He went back to Germany to Britain, and he worked undercover, and he worked for the underground in France or something. The guy was a badass. You would never guess by looking at him. But he did all his war record was unreal. As soon as the war started, he quit his acting career. When he was from Britain, he went back and enlisted. A lot of those dudes, the guy from. What's his name? Scotty from Star Trek. Didn't he land at Omaha Beach? Or at one of those beaches? I think he did.
Yeah, was he part of the D-Day invasion? I didn't know that.
I think he was.
That's an interesting tidbit.
I mean, it's...
That's James Doohan.
Yeah. All right, we got to talk a little bit about Bulls. We got to talk a little bit about the portal. And you were saying the Irish are the only team that... plus your buddy evidently has discovered the portal, Dabo. He's now grabbing guys off the portal.
Oh, okay. So Dabo's all in now.
He's all in.
After being so averse to it, and as a matter of principle, of course.
Well, we grabbed a couple quarterbacks.
The whole portal thing is it's kind of interesting because the playoff schedule and the portal schedule for when you have to submit your name so that you can be recruited, although there's got to be a lot of recruiting going on before pre-portal recruiting going on, especially when you have people, they put their name in, they're able to designate do not contact, and a day or two later they're signed, sealed, and delivered someplace else. But here's the problem with this, and the Irish are the only team in the playoffs that doesn't have everybody in the portal, but I don't know that we'll be able to say that at this time next week, because if you are going to land at your new school, you have to be situated in some cases by January 6th and in most, and in just about any other case, by January 13th. That's when they start their term. That's when classes begin at just about every college going, even the ones on the quarter system, because I went and looked and said, are there, you know, we see some of these schools that start, that work on quarters, and they don't start their school year until mid-September, where the others are starting in late August. But the way the quarters line up, they're on those same two dates, one or the other, either January 6th or January 13th this year. So if you, let's just say you're gonna put your name in, allow yourself to be recruited, you're going to take whatever time it is to evaluate different schools, you might want to take a visit or two, you know, you might want to do a few things like that, then you have to go through their admissions process and get all that paperwork in order, and you have to then enroll in your classes and be ready to go that week. That's a bit of a time suck, and so if you know it, a lot of people are saying, how can you walk away from your team now? If you're leaving, it's time. You have to do it because you only have a few weeks to work here.
Yeah, but it's the teams that have decided to play into January.
Well, yeah, it's the colleges themselves that have sort of imposed this on their athletes, and they're giving them a choice, and a lot of them are having to make choices that they might not really want to make, but they have no, you know, you got to look out for themselves. So I'm very sympathetic to the players who are in the transfer portal.
Well,
right now.
We mentioned the other day, and I was kind of wishing you were on. Well, you were. We talked about another topic on Monday, but if you talk to you and I still are burdened or blessed, whatever way to look at it, that there are some rules that somehow ought to be rules. You know, there is a rule someplace. A lot of younger people look at this world today, Kevin. They don't look at any kind of rule. There's no traffic. And I'm not saying they're bad people. Why should I be the only guy who's going 45 and a 45? I look like I'm driving a stagecoach. I mean, whatever's happened through the politics, the mayors, the presidents, whoever the hell it is, nobody pays attention to anything. I mean, Carl's always ragging about, rightfully so, you know, a couple of Supreme Court decisions that every hospital and every insurance company totally ignores. There's no enforcement anywhere on any of this stuff. Not to say you can't get pulled over for speeding in Ohio, where they still seem to give a crap, but other states don't. But what, when you and I still have these kind of thoughts that some of the stuff is sacred, I don't know if any of it's sacred. If you and I enter, I don't know if Notre Dame does this, but a lot of schools do this, where if you go through the business school and you get your degree in accounting, if you work harder, and I'm not saying the athletes are going to, they might include a fifth year where you come out with your accounting degree and your MBA. I turn around and say, hey, screw you guys. I'm here for 5 years. I can play ball for 5 years. Why do I got to play for four? Whose idea is that? I'm not so sure any of these
they
rules.
They wind up challenged.
Yeah, I'm not so sure any of these rules are sacred. Or maybe they shouldn't be. But if you're there
I think at this point where it stands is it's really, really hard for the NCAA to impose restrictions, certainly on certainly additional restrictions on transfers, any restrictions on NIL money and all of that. I think they're at the point where none of it's going to stand up in court if challenged. So if they really want to do anything, they're going to have to allow the players to form some kind of bargaining group, whether you call it a union or you call it a players association or whatever, and anything that they do is going to have to be collectively bargained. And that's sort of where the NFL is. Now, that that may actually wind up being a good thing for college football fans who don't like the constant movement and the constant churn. Because if you're going to bargain, one of the things that I'm sure from the college's side is they're going to ask for some kind of contract terms, that if you decide to choose a school, you have to be released, or, you know, whatever it is. It's a 2-year contract, it's a 3-year contract, or whatever it is, but you can't just up and leave. But boy, that's going to take some real concession from that side of the house, because right now they can just up and leave.
Well,
so
yeah,
what are you going to get in return is the question.
That's exactly my point. You're looking at today's contract. Okay, what if you and I were on the board of, you know, the Irish are so stuck, but in their own way of doing stuff, but we're on the board of Purdue or some damn place, and or Miami, Ohio, or someplace, I walk in, I bring in the football coach, or the AD probably, Mike, we'll use Mike Murphy. Mike, you recruited 25 people last year, and you signed 15. Yeah. What does the normal recruitment process look like? What do you mean? Tell me what you do. Who goes through films? Who calls who? Who are we paying on this end to do all that? And how much does it cost? Okay, Mike, and once you decide you kind of like this guy, somebody's going to go out and interview him, correct? Oh, yeah. Is he flying Southwest? Not exactly. Okay, he's flying a private jet. Well, yeah. How much does that cost? Now, if you like the kid, you're going to bring him here, correct? Is he flying Southwest? Nah, he's on a private jet. How much does that cost? And the kid's here for a weekend. We wine and dine him. Maybe we even bring his parents. Some schools are doing now. And now the kid comes here. Now, out of 50 kids we do this to, we sign, let's say, 15. Yeah, so what's the cost per kid? $30,000. Okay, whatever the number is. Right, so it's $90,000 for every guy we sign. Yeah. Now, what does he sign? He signs a 1-year commitment. So after 1 year, he can leave. Okay, now the first year, what's going to happen? Well, we're paying his tuition, paying his room and board, we're paying for his pizza at night, and we're coaching him. And if he grows, we got weight rooms, we got all these people that are, you know, body, what's the weight training people and all this kind of crap. What does it cost for, yeah, what does it cost for us per year to move this guy along in his career, his guy or his lady? Football's more like that because you got to beef people up and stuff. Oh, it's got to be tuition and everything. It's $200,000. All right? So after a year or 2 years, the guy leaves. And maybe he hasn't even played, but he's getting ready where he can play. Now the guy in front of him graduated, blah, blah, blah. And he leaves. Yeah. Okay, so we're 260 in the hole for this bleep. Yeah. And you got him on a 1-year contract. What's the matter with you? Why can't a school right now change their contract? Why does the NCAA, that doesn't seem to make any decisions, why does everybody sign the same contract? Why doesn't Notre Dame say tomorrow, this is at least a 2-year commitment or you owe us $100,000 back? I mean, what would stop somebody from doing that?
Right now, only if it makes them non-competitive. If it means people say, well, I'm not doing that because I can go to Alabama and not worry about that commitment.
Well, I mean...
And what stops the NCAA from doing it on the whole is they will probably lose in court. So it has to be bargained.
No, it doesn't. I got other things competitive. If all of a sudden Notre Dame's still signing guys, and Alabama says, geez, if they're getting away with it, so are we. And when somebody raises the price of gasoline... And everybody else looks at it and says, yeah, it's up because our wholesale price is up and everybody else raises it. They don't need to bargain. They just do it.
Yeah. Well, I get it. I get it. But gasoline is probably a bad example because it's either price fixing or darn close to it.
Why does everybody think that gasoline is probably, out of all the stuff in this world, is not competitive? It's probably the most competitive thing we buy. I mean, it isn't in the sense that you have stuff like special blends in the summer and those kinds of things, and maybe there's only regional refineries that do that. There's those bottlenecks, but in terms of the price is right in front of your face, You could drive by 8 different stations and pull into one that's a little cheaper. Name me anything else you can do that for. You sure as hell can't do it for an appendectomy.
Yeah, you can't. You absolutely can do that for gasoline, but of course, the ones, you know, they all tend to be the same price.
Well, but that's competitive,
there
right?
There may be one or two that stand out every once in a while, but that's it.
Well, there's a gazillion farmers that have no market power, and there's one price. It's just the price. If things are most competitive, it should be one price.
How much is it regulated?
What?
How much is pricing of gasoline regulated? I don't know the answer to that.
I think in the sense that there's summer blends and all that other kind of stuff, there's a lot. But the rest of it, I don't think it's regulated at all. And you have less companies, and you have less brands of stations than you had 25 years ago. So there's some of that, but there's still some independence. I don't think it's regulated at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, but they do all tend to wind up at the same price. You know, unless you go to Costco or something like that, and you're offsetting that with membership fees.
Well, but Costco's deal is, and you know, I'm a member. I don't know if I'm going to be for much longer, but I'm a member, and we have a couple people here that refuse to go to Costco, even though they're members.
Why is that?
Well, you know, my brother's the world's best guy. You got the best guy you ever want on your taking care of your money for sure. Remember Costco used to be All American Express?
I don't think that in my time as a member, I think that was gone.
Because that was, I'm going to say, 10 years ago. Maybe 12. The only thing you could use at Costco was American Express. It was one of the biggest deals from a credit card to one place. They wouldn't take anybody else's card. And
you know what? I've never tried to use a credit card there, so I've only used debit cards. I know at the gas line, they only accept debit cards. Inside, I don't know because I hardly ever go inside. I mean, for me, Costco's, you know, the gas, because it's not really out of the way for me to go get gas there, the gas savings alone more than pay for the membership.
Well, the...
And then on occasion, I'll go inside and get something.
Well, their markup might be a little less, but their shtick is on the... actually, one of the Core Digest guys wrote in a while back, how does Costco's gas a lot of times cheaper? Evidently, when they build a station in all their places, they build, like, twice as many tanks as they need. So whenever they get a refinery run where they can get it a little cheaper, they can fill up a boatload of gas.
Oh, okay. So they just hedge it.
Yeah.
They hedge it locally, actually.
Yeah. Whenever there's a... Because you'll see the stuff go up and down by the week. Like last 2 weeks ago, it was $2.99 out by Audrey, and then last week it was $3.29, and now this week it's back to $3.09 or something. When it was $2.99, they have more capacity to store it, evidently. Anywho, but a lot of your gas is tax. We had a discussion last night with somebody who had owned several Teslas. When are we going to figure out how we're going to tax electric cars, Kevin?
Oh, they will. I don't know when, but they will.
I want to know, as a driver of a regular car, why they aren't. Why am I paying the taxes? And not them.
Agreed.
I mean,
they use just as much road as I do.
Well, the idea, there's some logic to the gas tax. Okay, if the more gas you use, means really one of two things: the more you're driving, or the thing you're driving, like my old Suburban, is bigger and heavier than anybody else's out there, and is probably doing a little more damage to the road, right? So the gas tax made some semblance of sense. That the more gas you're using, you're either driving more or you're driving something bigger and heavier. Well, isn't a Tesla heavier than any other car out there with that battery in there?
It is.
And they pay nothing. Well, how does that work? They use the same roads I do. And allegedly, they have to re-engineer all these, you know, you see the metal barriers when you go around a curve in a road? Evidently, the Teslas will go right through it because they're too heavy. So they're thinking about having those all have to be replaced. I'm going to replace those for a car that's not even paying any taxes? Why would I do that? Maybe I should let them go off the cliff. Just saying.
Well, it's a risk. It should be a you know, eyes wide open, it's a risk you chose to take.
What do you think would happen if the next year Notre Dame and Michigan and a couple of other schools changed the contract and said, here's the deal. We're doing this for you. You're not leaving with $250,000 of our money in your pocket and just heading somewhere else.
Well, if they collude, they're going to have a problem.
But no, don't. Just make somebody sign it.
Yeah, but if they do it in concert, they're probably going to have a problem. So, again, this is all going to get it's all turning into legal battles. There's still stuff. We had that recent House decision. Now. You know, and that was a class action suit, and that got settled. But now there's going to be another one there because there's several more that are working their way through the courts.
I
go back to what I've been saying all along. This is the NCAA's fault because they just assumed that they would never lose, that in the end that they would win all the lawsuits. And as soon as they lost and the floodgates got open, they weren't prepared with any kind of structure or any kind of rules that they could put into place. If they had gotten out in front of this, geez, how long ago, you know, was it like 12 years ago that we were on the air here talking about the O'Bannon case? If they would have just jumped out in front of things then, they'd probably have this under, you know, on a much more controlled basis now. But they didn't, and so it, you know, it just became the Wild West.
But why, Kevin, why, I mean, this, I mean, first of all, you're not going to get any disagreement out of me that the world somehow has become incredibly litigious. But I'll give you an example of sort of the same thing. It's actually very similar. My first job was at Allied Van Lines because I wanted to do stuff with small businesses. I didn't plan on staying there very long, and I didn't. But when I graduated University of Chicago, the University of Chicago grad school education was, I'm going to say, $3,000 a year, so six total, right? So one class now is more than my entire education was, 20 classes, which is pretty scary when you think about it. So if you would have gone to Allied Van Lines, General Motors, Pullman, you name it, and said, I'm going to go to grad school, they'd just pay for it. They didn't care. It cared maybe, but it was $3,000 a year. It was $6,000 to get somebody with an MBA, okay? And you went at night, you busted your fanny and all that stuff. But all of a sudden, that number, even this is my early years at Pullman, that number became five, then it became six, then it became seven, and finally somebody goes, wait a minute, if we're sending you there after your 2 years, if you don't stay here at least 2 years, you owe us half the tuition back, or something along those lines.
Yeah, I had one, that kind of deal.
But you didn't have to go to the Supreme Court. They just did it. All of a sudden it said, we're not paying $60,000 a year, and you take off the minute you get it. We're not doing that.
But they didn't get together with everybody else in the industry and say,
right.
Okay, let's draft our agreement and impose this on all our employees.
No,
because that's when it becomes collusive, and now you have to start asking.
And you're right. Would you go to play maybe Notre Dame the package between you getting money coming to you, the training, the tuition, the chow. You name it, the package is worth, well, it's easily $200,000 a year if you're making 50.
Well, it is, except that it's not worth. It doesn't cost the school that.
But the
school on margins doesn't spend nearly that. But okay, keep going.
So I mean, if it costs $250, and Notre Dame says, okay, if you're here 2 years, that's $500. If you leave, either the other now maybe the other school will pick it up. You owe us how many times now? Does somebody else pick up? You know, if somebody is leaving with a you know, even a trading firm. Somebody goes somewhere else. How many other times will pay out, buy you out of your non-compete clause? Sometimes they will. So if the guy goes to Alabama and they go, oh, here the number is only 50 if you leave after 2 years. That's part of the competitive process. That's not wrong. That's correct, right?
Yeah, I think if it, you know, we'll go back to your Notre Dame example. If Notre Dame wants to do that kind of a clawback or however they want to do it. They're going to have to sweeten the pot. They're going to have, if they want to bargain individually a restriction, they're probably to make it work and to make it worthwhile for people to give that concession. They're going to have to do something that makes, you know, that sweetens their own pot a little bit more, whether it's a higher payout or whatever it's going to be. you know, hey, you can put together any kind of a deal you want. The question, you know, the question I have is, are these universities smart enough to do it? Maybe.
What?
Some of them are pretty dumb.
Some of them are pretty dumb. I think the first one to fall.
You know, just don't let the Bears run your operation.
Well, I think the first pillar to fall is going to be you can only play 4 years. Why? In today's world, if you want an educated offspring, not that everybody has to do this, I'm just you might say, wait a minute, my kid's going to Alabama. He's gonna do undergrad in economics, like I did. Why he would do that, I don't know. And by the way, he's going to go to a business school. He's going to be here 6 years. He plays football. Why the hell can't he play all 6 years? He's not a pro. Why can't he play?
That should be the model that the NCAA wants to embrace, the whole student-athlete model.
Yeah, well, I mean,
but you know,
how old is George?
They've always tried to legislate a competitive environment unsuccessfully, consistently unsuccessfully. Because really, you know, those rules only matter to the people who intend to follow them.
Well, you know, I not to inject anything. You know, talk about a weird story, Kevin. We used to go down to spring training every year back in the early '80s, back before the Cubs were any good, and I loved it. I'd go down and I'd go out to.
There was a time before when the Cubs were good.
Well, no, before they were any good.
I know about before.
Before the Tribune first bought
it. A couple of years pause, it's probably been, there is no before, it just, the Cubs aren't any good. But we digress.
But they had, the place where they played at not Fitchfield, what was it, Hohokam Park, had beautiful soccer fields, right? That's what you parked at, right? So I'd go down there at 9 o'clock in the morning, back when I was in really good shape, and they had 100-yard fields, and I'd run a whole bunch of sprints and run a half mile around it. And I put my sweats on, and I head over to Fitchfield where all the minor leaguers are playing. And I got to watch minor league practice for like 2 hours. I was in seventh heaven watching all these guys. And I love watching baseball practice with all those people on the field, and guys are hitting and guys are fielding and stuff. And you can tell so much about people when they get 15 ground balls in a row and the coach is bitching at them. Hey, do not pull that ball close to your chest. That guy's safe at first base. What's the matter with you? You know, just what it's like to be in the major leagues, how much different it is than playing softball in the neighborhood. Anyway, so I meet this young lady. I'm 32-ish or 31, so it's not like I'm robbing a cradle. And she's 24, 25, still going to ASU. Everybody's working, waitresses at nights or guys are bartending in the spring. They cut back to like 9 hours. Everybody's on the 6 or 7 year plan at ASU. they're all still college students, but they're working. They're making more money as a waitress or a bartender than they would if they actually got their first job. So they pushed it out. Who's to say those people, if you take 9 hours and you're progressing toward your degree, why can't you play football for 7 or 8 years? I mean, who says no, other than the fact that it used to be four? I mean, how old was George Gipp, 25 or something?
Yeah, well, he didn't start. You know, he started later, too.
Well, so those guys, I mean...
It was different times, but yes.
But I mean,
I wouldn't be surprised to see that challenged at some point.
I mean, who's to say? I'm not. Why even? Who's? I guess when you say you keep saying challenge, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but who even is making the rules now? Who do you even challenge? Who's the grand poobah of college? NCAA doesn't run these people.
Here's where it will fall, because there are rules committees for the NCAA, and then it goes to a full vote. Of the member schools before they implement anything like that. Right now, though, there is process for people to get that fifth year if they had an injury. You know, I mean, there's some specific rules about if you don't play any more than X, then you just get you file the paperwork and you get the extra, the extra year. But there have been people who have had multiple injuries and they want to come back for a sixth year. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of rhyme or reason to when they're granted and when they're not, but I've seen it granted and I've seen it not granted. I think this is where you're going to see the challenge, the legal challenge, because for the most part, what you've seen so far is people have just accepted those decisions whichever way they went. I think if when it looks arbitrary, it's pretty hard to defend in the legal system.
Well, Kevin,
that's where somebody's going to win a case, and then if the NCAA is prepared, they'll have a response and a new rule structure for it, and if the NCAA behaves like the NCAA, they will instead just throw up their hands and say, okay, everybody can play as much as you
want. Well, the words, I wish I knew who the actor was, in like the first or second episode of the Boardwalk Empire, I only watched a few, where the guy says to Nucky, hands him the envelope, and Nucky says, I wasn't involved in that heist. And the guy goes, Nucky, you're in charge of this operation. You can't be half a gangster. You're either in or you're out. Right? All these rules, but you're talking about, you and I are talking about, what did Mike Royko say about Ronald Reagan? He had this amazingly holistic view of an America that never existed or something along those lines. But you and I are talking about a college team where their focus was to make some money for the school, be an extracurricular activity, and oh, by the way, be a minor league for the NFL. Kevin, that ship has sailed. They are now a competitor to the NFL. The same person who says, oh, no, you can only play 4 years, goes, wait a minute, these guys play five or six. All of a sudden, college football is better. We have more people on the team that can play. And, oh, by the way, we're going to play a 14-game season, and we're going to have a whatever playoff just like the pros. By the way, the playoff is about as big as the pros now, isn't it? What is the pros playoff? Well, it's four plus three.
But you make a good point. We've kind of been talking about this sham of the student-athlete for many, many years anyway, this extracurricular activity sham.
Well, it wasn't when there was only nine games.
There are sports where that's still true. Even if I wouldn't necessarily consider it an extracurricular activity, it still does follow the student-athlete model. Soccer is an example, certainly things like rowing and so on. But there are people who are in a tennis program for a year or two who are in, and then they want to become pros. There are people in the soccer program who want to become pros and pursue a pro career. So those exist. Women's basketball is sort of in the middle and moving more and more to what the men's model has been. But they still, the WNBA's collective bargaining agreement prevents people from leaving. Almost always they have to play the full 4 years in college, and in some cases you can enter the draft after 3 years. So they have a little bit different model where people do have to stay in school, and the women tend to be better students than their male counterparts when it comes to athletes versus athletes, women athletes versus men.
Well, Kevin, it wasn't that long ago, and I ran into somebody last night that was giving me the, wasn't it always like that? It's just a matter of degree. No, it's not. I mean, it's like saying, a 2-inch rain in your backyard is the same as a tsunami. One knocks you down the block and kills you. The other one gets your feet wet.
They're both rain, though.
Yeah, they're both rain. But I mean,
no, you're thinking monsoon, not tsunami.
Well, we're a lot of water.
Yeah.
But I mean, my freshman year, freshmen couldn't play. Okay, you played. You the football team. I think arrived. We arrived Labor Day weekend, right? Maybe 2 days early, get your crap together in a dorm, and class started the day after Labor Day. The football team, I think, showed up 2 weeks before. Might have been three, but or two and a half, but I think it was two.
Something like that, though.
Something like that. You played 9-10 games. You were done at Thanksgiving, and only the year before had they started a bowl game because they were like number three in the country. They hadn't played a bowl game since the 20s, since the Rose Bowl or someplace. And that, to me, is 90% extracurricular activity. Now, it doesn't to say that one of those guys, 80%.
Or even 50-50. But now go to the lacrosse team or somebody like that, that they spend the summer on campus too, and they're playing for national championships and all of it. And
well, it was a club team when we were there.
But they're not going to go make a fortune,
right,
in playing professional lacrosse. They will, several of the players will play professionally, but they're not going to make a fortune doing it, so it behooves them to do well in school, too.
So I think we have I think we might have Russell. How much do you think Russell made betting on his team last night? Because they kicked some ass.
They did okay. They tried to lose it in the end. Thank goodness I was asleep. They tried to give it up. You know, the quarterback for Memphis is the only quarterback in college football that started the last 4 years at the same school.
Well, you know, I did hear that last night.
Or I guess was, because last night was his last game. And they specifically chose to go to that bowl. They shot down a couple of other ones because it was like 20 minutes from his hometown.
You got to tell me, who the hell is Scooter Coffee?
No idea what Scooter Coffee is. I assume it's some coffee brand in Texas.
Because they're the ones that sponsored the bowl, right?
Yeah, they were. And you know, they played it at soccer stadium, Dallas Football Club.
Really? Because they kept saying it was
it only seats like 20,000 or so. That was very much of a, and it used to be a different bowl that was in Florida, and they moved it. But this is one of those ESPN bowls that's really made for television, so they can fill a Tuesday night.
I originally thought when they said Texas, it might be the old Cotton Bowl, but it wasn't. It was a soccer stadium.
No, it was a soccer stadium. Yeah,
that's a good idea too. There's no sense having 50,000 empty seats.
No, not at all. And really, when they chose to go to that one, everybody, you know, there was a bunch of why aren't you going to a, because they could have gone to a better bowl. They're ranked, but they specifically chose because that kid chose to stay with the team for the last. Every year for 4 years, and he's a good quarterback. I think you may see him, you know, on a practice squad somewhere, or pull a Kurt Warner at some point. Because, another thing with jumping around and everything else, and not getting some consistency, you know, that Malcolm Gladwell or whoever, that 10,000 hours to become really good at something. Years ago, there were more starting quarterbacks in the NFL at a Conference USA than the major conferences. And it was, and I believed it was because these guys would show up as freshmen and get to start all 4 years.
Yeah, you could be right. And
I have all these mid-tier, you know, conference theories because it's what I focus on.
Yeah, but you get a Josh Allen, you get, go back a little farther, Ben Roethlisberger. You know, a lot of these guys.
Who was really good for the Vikings?
Who was really good for the Vikings?
Yeah, they had a really good quarterback.
How far are you going back? Fran Tarkenton? You going back to Tarkenton?
They had somebody out of the MAC that played for them for a while, but they also had,
And that's really where that when he was a quarterback, Conference USA, and Memphis was a Conference USA school. There was one weekend where there were more Conference USA graduates starting in the NFL than any other conference. And I had this belief that it was because they had the consistency of getting to start all 4 years while they were in college.
I could make a suggestion there. By the way, haven't there been two serious NFL quarterbacks? I'm thinking Tony Romo might be one of them from Eastern Illinois.
Yeah, Tony Romo's from Eastern Illinois. The guy that's the coach for the Broncos, Sean Payton, played quarterback at Eastern Illinois and played in the NFL for a while. And it's what's the guy? The 49ers went to the Super Bowl. Before last year, he was their quarterback.
Not Brock Purdy.
No, not Purdy. Purdy's from like Iowa State. What's the guy's name? He was originally drafted by the Patriots and they traded him.
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the name.
Yeah, he played at Eastern Illinois, and all these guys were coached by the head coach there was a fellow named Bob Spoo. Who passed away a couple of years ago. But Spoo was the longtime coach at Eastern Illinois, and he coached all of these guys. And then before that, he was the quarterback's coach and offensive coordinator at Purdue. So he had Mark Herman, he had Jim Everett. He had Scott Campbell. He had all of those guys as under his tutelage as well.
Was he the guy from New Orleans? What's his name? The guy who just retired, the guy from New Orleans? Was he still coach there?
No, I'm if you're about. Thinking Sean Payton.
No, no, I'm talking about who's the guy who just... who was the quarterback in New Orleans?
Oh, by the time he... I know you're talking about him, just blanking on the name.
Yeah, because he tried
to. By the time he was there, Bob had moved on to Eastern Illinois. And the reason I like to cite his record is Bob was my high school head coach.
Really? Ah.
Well, it's.
Okay, are you ready for
He was a really outstanding.
Well, let me
coach.
Give you one more little nugget on this. I'm sure you know the coach, Russell, Doug Redman. He played in the OEX forever, and he was a coach. He played for Illinois, a lineman, and he was an offensive coordinator at Purdue for a while. And then when he didn't get the head coaching job, he came down to Florida to trade. Talk about a character. I mean, he's been on the show a couple times. He was the guy, Kevin and Russell, that when Purdue played Wisconsin, he gave all the offensive linemen red gloves. So the refs couldn't tell if they were holding on the red shirts. And there's actually a rule now. You can't wear gloves the color of the other guy's jersey. It's like the Doug Redman rule in the NCAA. Because the coach is one of those guys, if you're not on the edge of the... I won't say if you're not cheating, but if you're not on the edge of the rules, you're not trying. But one day, he was quiet in the OEX. I said, Coach, how come nobody throws at a tight end or whatever? So Coach immediately dropped off his trading face and one of his coaching face. He goes, Tommy, let me tell you. Virtually every school, the quarterback has one decision. You'll see somebody go out on a fly pattern. They'll throw the ball to him, and there's three guys on the defense hanging around the guy, and there's four other guys open. That's the way most schools coach. Schools like Notre Dame, they're going to have two decisions, so they're a cut above everybody. Mm-hmm. There's only maybe three schools where you actually teach people to have three decisions. One is BYU, and the other is Purdue. That's why you've got Jim McMahon, and who's the other guy, a left-handed guy in the Hall of Fame, came out of BYU, and why all these other guys came out of Purdue. Because they teach the quarterbacks much like a pro system. They have two checkoffs. They have three decisions to make. Because nobody else does that. Obviously, your guy at Eastern Illinois, the same way. If you learn that when you're in college, that's why do you think Justin Fields and these other guys have so much trouble coming to the pros? They're not used to checking off three people. They're not used to recognizing a defense and selecting their receiver at the line. They're told, Joe's going to do a 15-yard down and out. You throw to Joe if the entire team is standing around him. That's what you see most teams do, right? Very few have a checkoff system like a... I don't think this kid at Notre Dame has that at all either. Kevin, I don't know. I don't even know. He's a great athlete, and he's been effective, but he's not what you call a pro quarterback, is he?
No, he's... Actually, I think he will be a really great slot receiver for anybody who's smart enough to make him that, because he's a fantastic runner, and he'd be really good after the catch. Riley Leonard is a good run-pass option quarterback, and he's improved a lot as the season has gone on. But I wouldn't be asking him to throw deep downfield very often because he's not very accurate at that. But he is really good throwing that 10-12-yard pass, and especially off the run-pass option. Two things real quickly, and then I'm gonna leave you guys. The quarterback we were trying to...
You're beating me to it. Go.
Go. Well, you can go. You got him.
No, you go. I was all excited.
It was Dante Culpepper.
Dante Culpepper from
Central Florida. And speaking of Vikings quarterbacks and ex-quarterbacks, guess who's getting benched this week in favor of a rookie?
Not the guy who just beat the shit out of the Bears.
Kirk Cousins.
Really?
Yeah, they're going to bench him and play Michael Penix. So the saga there is people very eyebrow raising when the Falcons signed Cousins to a like $100 million contract, long-term contract, at his age and coming off of, I think it was Achilles tendon surgery, and recovering. But his last five games, he has one touchdown pass and nine interceptions. The Falcons are still in the playoff hunt. But they are going to turn the keys over to Michael Penix, and see if he can do better.
Are you talking about the Falcons or the Vikings?
I'm talking about the Falcons, okay. But this was Kirk Cousins who left the Vikings right. after a long career there. So, kind of an interesting development there, speaking of ex-Vikings quarterbacks. And, of course, everybody was saying, well, what are the Vikings going to do? Well, they went and drafted McCarthy in the first round, and he got injured for the season. And now people were saying, what really are the Vikings going to do? And it turns out that they've had a pretty good year out of Sam Darnold.
Yeah.
Who will get some MVP votes, is not going to be the MVP, but he's probably going to be the most improved player in the league.
Well, the guy we're thinking about was Drew Brees.
Yeah, Drew Brees was the name we couldn't remember. But
what did he do? He got this TV contract. He was on like 2 weeks, and they got rid of him. Was he that bad?
Well, a lot of these guys are pretty boring. Remember when Joe Montana tried to do TV?
Yeah.
Yeah, Montana is he's a pleasant fellow. But not really a big, he's not going to fill up the TV screen on you with his personality.
Well, they're not Dan Dierdorf. When Dan got the chance for the job, Dan went and broadcast hockey for the whole year, and he knew nothing about hockey because he forced himself to learn the game, learn the people, to learn how to do it. These other guys aren't going to do that. They just show up and just talk football.
Yeah, well, so you have to be good at a few things. You have to have a personality that people enjoy. So that's number one, and it has to come through on the TV screen. But the other thing is you have to be good at talking about football in a very plain-spoken way without, trivializing the game.
What's your first read on both of you guys, and we'll let you go, Kevin, on Tom Brady? I still like Romo better.
Yeah, I think so. Brady's coming along, though. I've heard him do a few games this year, and he's better now than he was at the beginning of the year. And Brady's a pretty driven guy. And I can't imagine him allowing himself to suck at the job.
No, I don't. I can't. Well, Kevin, thank you much. We'll talk to you on Friday. Russell, we got all kinds.
Yes.
I was talking to a listener the other night who came in, and he's a listener and a client. Interesting guy because he has been involved in the electric vehicle world for a while. I mean, because and he's a farmer. So we had an adult beverage together. I really enjoyed myself. Good guy. He works more with Dan than he does with me. But when I talk to people who listen, some people will say, our ladies that listen from Arizona and from Ohio, from when we used to be out in Arizona, they say, sometimes I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And I said, well, should I dumb it down? No, don't ever dumb it down. Mm-hmm. And this guy says, whenever you say, this is going to get a little too technical, I turn the radio up, right? Because that's what I really want to hear. So, so it is amazing how whenever you and I, launch into, or with Hal sometimes I do, launch into some, thing on volatility and some abstract stuff, there's a lot of people really want to hear that. So, good. I mean, it's a, we try not to do too much of everything, the same thing on one day. But what do you make of, I saw a phenomenon a week ago where the VIX was going down in the equities, and yet the volatility was going way up in the gold and silver and stuff. And now that seems to be going back the other way. It's weird the way this stuff's moving around, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of what do I do in 2025? And regardless of, the certainty that we got knowing who got elected president, who's going to be our president for, legally for the next 4 years, without deviating into things that could possibly happen. But, we know who it's going to be. I don't think there's a whole lot of certainty around, what he's going to do. That's been kind of my attitude as well. Is I go through periodic rejiggering of my portfolio, and I'm basically all cash right now until I start to see how things are going to go after this guy gets in office and he says what he's going to do, and or he starts to do what he said he was going to do. Uncertainty. Gold in the metals like that, geopolitical uncertainty, those markets like that an awful lot as far as volatility goes. And as far as the equity markets go, you got two different camps. You got one camp that thinks it's going to be a wonderful business friendly environment for the next 4 years. In fact, I saw the. I can't believe I actually saw a CEO say something negative about the current administration. But one, I think it was the JetBlue CEO said that the incoming administration's something to the extent of the current administration is not very business friendly, and she's looking forward to the new administration coming in. I couldn't, and that had to do with JetBlue trying to merge with Spirit Airlines and it getting shut down.
Well, I mean, I don't know that.
So, and what I mean, where I'm going with that is, you know, there's probably this belief that we're going to be somewhat business friendly, and you know, until COVID kicked in, Trump was presiding over one of the lowest volatility equity markets on record.
Yeah,
I mean, as volatile as that guy is, you know, if you told me what the average VIX was for the first 3 years of his administration in the first 3 years of anybody else's administration, his is probably going to be lower, and most people wouldn't guess that just because of the behavioral stuff that they know about him.
But it was still more volatile. This is not accusatory, but I think it was still a little more volatile. The Obama, there were like, wasn't there like 3 years? Was it Obama's second term? Or we didn't have a 1% move in a day for like 3 years, did we?
No, I mean, there was a long period of time that we, you know, didn't have any kind of outlier move whatsoever.
What current situation, I look and see what the man wants to do, but he also says so many things that, you know, when you come right
down
to it.
That's why you just got to, and you can't react to the, we all learn, everybody, we went through about a week where people said, I guess we're going to start trading off of his tweets and stuff. That was only like a 2 or 3 week phenomena back when he first became president, when he said we're going to renegotiate something with Boeing, and Boeing got hit, and everybody tried to guess what was he going to say next, and he really never, you know, did anything else like that. So I don't really think we're going to be investing based on based on what comes out of his mouth.
Right now,
I actually think he's. I think he formulates what he really wants to do, and he formulates a lot of things out loud.
I don't really have an issue with that, and I'm really hoping for. I think, you know, with the 4 years being in there and making a lot of mistakes, some of it being overruled by COVID, which wasn't his problem. Although I do think that he kind of looked the other way and us sending the money over there, but I don't know the details of that, so no point in going into that. But I will say that it makes me a little nervous. From maybe it's my Catholic upbringing, I see these huge firms taking over massive amounts of the economy and buying newspapers and doing those kinds of things, and now they seem to all be going down to a place and essentially writing the guy a check for $1 million, which I don't know what that means for campaign law. Well, what's the point of even having a campaign law if you don't give somebody $500 or something, but by the way, you give $1 million towards the biggest inauguration ever? I mean, are these laws just laughable? And young people,
yeah, it's just like, you know what? Let's just go back and repeat the first hour where you basically said that NCAA rules are nothing but guidelines and nobody really has to follow them. And you're seeing, and I think you really did touch on a big societal thing that got the wheels turning this morning with me when I was listening to the first hour. That's in like every part of our society.
Yeah.
Because you guys even mentioned there were some things that have just not even been enforced by the federal government. And AOC, bless her heart, she's on record saying that the Obama administration should just ignore some of the things that the Supreme Court said that they should do. I can't remember what the topic was.
I think it had to do with the sanctuary cities or something.
Yeah,
it had to do with the hospitalization stuff. It had to do with
ignore just ignore what the other branch of government says you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Well, the whole idea behind having the three is that they can offset each other. If they start ignoring each other, you know, or doing the opposite of what one says, you know, who's to say? And this sounds—it's going to sound kind of ridiculous, but. I think a lot of things that end up coming true sound kind of ridiculous. Who's to say that the commander-in-chief doesn't get one of his generals to arrest everybody on the Supreme Court because he doesn't like something they decided?
Well, I mean,
You know, if the different branches of government to ignore each other when by law they're supposed to be doing certain things, that's when we just completely turn into a
banana. Well, we have a group that makes the laws, allegedly.
Yeah.
We have a group that interprets the laws, allegedly. And we have a group run by the president that enforces the laws and does other stuff. But there's so many laws, you decide which ones you're going to. And everybody thinks, I mean, I happen to think that, you know, Trump's got all his buddies in jail. The guy's guilty of something, right? But I will say this. I mean, the guy's always been somewhat of a sleazebag and not paying people and paying people off and stuff. But the fact is, I don't think that anybody in this country, and this has happened to people that I know, anybody in this country should have a million or $2 million legal bill run up by their government. Nobody's got that kind of money.
You
might as well just throw somebody in jail without even having a trial. What's the difference? I mean,
there's just so much. It's so easy to weaponize the legal system, especially against individuals. If you say, well, if you really want to take this to court, you're going to need to show up on these 5 dates before we even start to get into the trial, and you're basically going to be giving up a year of your life to do nothing but fight this thing. That right there is incentive enough to just automatically settle, given the opportunity to settle.
Well, you've been involved with people that have done stuff like this. And one of the biggest mysteries, and I sure wish, you know, maybe if George Stigler was still alive and had a bunch of people researching it, because he was a governmental economist, maybe he could put together a paper on it. But I always try and understand, Russell, and I absolutely do not, what exactly are you buying? Now, say, for instance, I'll drag you behind out of the, you know, white picket fence area and dump you in Lincoln Park, and all of a sudden somebody's running. Kevin's running for president, okay? So you become a bundler. You know some wealthy people, which you do. And all of a sudden, in your Lincoln Park home, you get a bartender and you get some whores d'oeuvres and have, you know, 10 people over to meet Kevin O'Neill for a coffee, or Paul Vallis, or whoever the hell it is. And now all of a sudden, it's $1,000 to come to the Rhodes household, and you're going to have 15 people. And at the end of the day, everybody gets to shake hands and talk to Kevin O'Neill and blah, blah, blah. I don't know, we're gonna do some Kevin or with Lou. With somebody. And all of a sudden, you write the check for $15,000. So you're a bundler. Now, the people who paid the G, what do they get out of the deal? The fact that they got to meet the guy and ask a question and decide per person if they like the guy or not. I don't know what else they could get out of the deal. Now, does the bundler get the cell phone of the campaign manager, one of the rummies in the group? What can he do? Now, what if the check's $150,000? What do I get? Do I get Kevin's phone number? Do I get to call him if it's a big deal? If there's a major favor? What if it's a court case? I mean, what do I get as I walk up the chain? And now we've got these guys, the Meta guy, and all these guys went down to Mar-a-Lago, and it seems like the number's $1 million. They're all ponying up. The Google guy, anyways, like four or five guys. What do I get for that $1 million? Now, that's a lot of money, but it's still, for a firm like that, it's not their dough. And how does a firm even make that contribution when you're not supposed to? But now, I have a feeling that to contribute to an inaugural ball is off limits. You get to do whatever you want there. That's not considered a campaign contribution. It's a, I don't know if it's a party. Now, what did I just buy? Did I buy total immunity from antitrust for 4 years? But I'm saying
I don't know about that part.
I don't know. I mean, what does Trump think he sold, and what does the person think he bought for that amount of dough? Now the weird part with the Commonwealth Edison Madigan thing is, Commonwealth Edison got what they bought. They got the higher rates. Now they're trying to put Madigan in jail. Yet Commonwealth Edison got the higher rates. The losers on the thing are you and me. And they're not going to...
Paid more and a little bit of Madigan, but I think they'll probably treat him well in jail.
But, I mean, the idea that, okay, you gave this guy $1 million, I'll make it one number, and he pushed through this rate increase that you bleeps didn't deserve, which is $5 a month for everybody. Doesn't seem like... Now, you would think that if you and I were playing Caesar on this deal, well, let's see. We'll put Madigan in jail. We're going to give some massive fine and maybe put a few people in jail at Commonwealth Edison. We're going to say nobody was on the board at that time gets to be on a board again. And, oh, by the way, the $5, it's been around for 5 years, you better replace that with $60. Everybody better get a check for $300, and it better be off next month's bill. That's the only way, in my Catholic upbringing, to resolve the whole thing. Yet that's not going to happen, is it?
No.
Now, why do we only go a little bit of the way? Who are we afraid of? Why can't we take it to its logical conclusion?
Which is, what's a logical conclusion?
Well, if they got 400 hours out of the Rhodes household they shouldn't have got because they paid off the guy, you should get your 400 hours back, shouldn't you?
You would think, but yeah, I don't think it's going to get to that point.
No, but I mean, why not? Yeah. I guess is my question.
Why not? You know, okay, I'll give you the first argument that comes up. You know, what about the people that haven't lived here over the period of time that it got hiked?
Somebody did.
You know, you start having to go through the, you know, who was actually damaged by the thing.
Well, if somebody
I think what you end up doing is you, instead of sending a check to everybody, what you should do is you should charge lower rates for the next
year or two. Let's at least take 5 hours off going forward. Yeah. But I don't even do that. That's the easiest part. But now, wait a minute. You're a math guy. If the Rhodes Group sells your house in La Suburbia and moves downtown, okay, you're buying that house from somebody. Somebody paid the electric bill in that place, and everybody's just moving around. So what if they gave the new owner of the Rhodes place 3 years back, and now you get 3 years back at the other place? You're going to get it from someplace.
I'm talking about out of state.
Oh yeah, okay, well.
That's what I'm talking. Just because I've moved in and out of Chicago periodically, so.
All right,
I moved around back in the day.
You move around. You move out of state, you lose. How's that?
Yeah.
What do you say we go to break real quick? S&P futures up 17. Nasdaq futures up 43. We come back. Russell's going to talk Fed. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Low and Opec Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 16. NASDAQ Futures down 38. We were up more before, and now we're leaking a little bit. We have the Fed announcement today. They've been in a two-day meeting, so they get 2 days of tuna fish sandwiches is their deal. And they will come out today. The expectation is a quarter point decrease in rates, and then some mumbo-jumbo to go with it. I think that they've already pretty much, the rates are already down because we went to the auction this week for people. So I think that it's already been done. They're just kind of admitting what they've been doing. We still have they're pouring money into the system, so the rates have absolutely gone down like you would expect. Dow futures are up 166. Now, the Dow has been down a 9-day losing streak. Of course, as you put stuff on the Dow, none of these things are what you call the industrials anymore. I didn't even realize that NVIDIA is now in the Dow, and so is Sherwin-Williams Paint, which I sure as hell would never have guessed. I remember my computer's a little. We're working here. The Andrew, you might have to do traffic, weather, and sports early. Why don't you do that while I get this thing cooking?
All right.
Oh,
sure.
Never mind. Oop. Dex up 25.1%. FTSE up 4. Call that flat. CAC around up 2. Call that flat. So there. This is interesting. We'll have to have Russell comment on this. Nissan and Honda are thinking of merging, which is interesting. And in the European stocks, Renault is up 6% after reports of those guys merging. So they think somebody's going to grab Renault. I don't know how big Renault even is anymore. Over in Asia, we have the, what this thing is, I get too much stuff up here, Andrew. The Nikkei down 282, 39,081, trying to get to 40,000, now it's had 2 days in a row the other way. Hang Seng up 164.8%, 19,864, trying to get back over 20,000. Shanghai up 20.6%. Yesterday in the U.S., we were Dow was down 267, again, 9 days in a row. S&P down 23, NASDAQ down 64. Bonds, we're up 4 basis points, 4.42. We've been plus or minus is 4.4 for really quite a while. We'll see if the Fed shakes that up today. The Bund up 2 basis points, 2.25. Japan, 107. And we have oil, which has been fluttering around the $70 mark. $70.84, so that's a full 1%. That's as high as I've seen in a while. We've been between 67 and 72, like for the longest period. Brent up 57, 73, 76. Natural gas up a dime, 340. Must be going to get cold. Gold, which has been having a pretty crummy week, up a buck 50, 26.63. Silver down 4 cents, 30.87. Copper unchanged at 415. Foreign exchange. Dollar still under, or put it this way, the euro dollar is still under 105, 104.88. So the dollar's been strong against the euro, not as strong against the pound, 127.07. So the pound is hung in there. The pound versus euro trade's kind of been the one, and we'll ask Russell to comment on that as well. Bitcoin up now down 1600, 104.952. I still think that thing is a danger piece up at that height, but nobody seems to care. Andrew, we got for us traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:37 here in Chicago, Wednesday, December 18th. Just a little bit of sports here. The Blackhawks finally won. They won over the Capitals 3-2 last night.
Two in a row.
Yeah, that is probably the best we can get here in Chicago, so we'll take it. But yeah. Over at Chicago weather, it is currently 35 degrees. We're going to have a high of 36 today. You might have a little bit of snow, just a little bit of flurries here and there in the morning. Otherwise, it'll be just a little bit of clouds throughout the day. And over in Phoenix, they're currently at 38 degrees, but it's definitely going to warm up. There's going to be a high of 82, and that very well might break the record set in 1950 of 79 degrees today.
Now,
yeah, it's getting warm. So finally, for Chicago traffic, looks like, thankfully, no major accidents to report. If you're on the inbound, basically all directions, things are looking pretty heavy. If you're on the outbound, keep an eye out for the Eisenhower near Harlem Avenue or on the Kennedy. Basically all the way from Kennedy to downtown. So that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, Fed, China, what do you want to talk about first? Honda-Nissan merger, what are you thinking?
Well, I'll answer the pound-euro thing real quick. It's just a major interest rate differential and a major differential between what people think is going to happen in 2025 with the risk-free rate in the Eurozone versus the risk-free rate in the UK. They're expecting a much more aggressive cuts in the Eurozone than for the pound. In fact, they may only get one cut next year in the UK as opposed to other places in the world that are going to get 3, 4, or 5. So there's just there are unique issues in that part of the world.
Why do you think all these central banks think they have the all clear to start inflating again? They never dealt with the.
I don't know, man. They're not. You know, they're doing things that they don't necessarily need to do just because they can do them. I feel like the U.S. Fed is a bit better than some of the other ones, in that we're not cutting rates just because we can. It seems like Powell really just wants to cut rates because it's something that's needed. You know, we've been in such an environment. Everything's about how everybody's attitudes around rules have changed over the last couple of decades this morning. And, you know, the role of the Fed is supposed to be to do two things. The Fed mandate, which I think answers more questions talking about the mandate than anybody else that's had that job in my career.
Oh yeah.
Which I like that. I like that as well, because and I think everybody hates him because of that. Because I think it's one of the reasons that he gets such a bad rap is because, you know, people ask about the equity markets, and he said, well, that doesn't fall under the dual mandate, which is, you know, the best employment environment that we can have with the lowest inflation. That's what they're supposed to be doing. So, you know, if you don't need to cut to manage the economy, don't cut.
But they already have.
I'm just saying it not with respect to the current context, but what they should be doing,
right,
and how they should be behaving.
If you were on a panel,
you know, we don't follow rules anymore. We just decide to do what we think is best for, you know, what's best as opposed to what, you know, what we're supposed to be doing.
If you were on a learned panel, all you FID guys, you know, your PhD dudes,
mm-hmm,
be sitting there, and I were to say something, you know, something crazy like I always do, it wouldn't be stupid, actually, I don't think. If I were to say, in my opinion, by watching the Fed, their number one priority now is to maintain this wealth bubble for rich people, and they don't care about
that. That's how they're acting. You know, we haven't talked to, this is going to sound like I'm a shameless plug, but I'm writing a book on Warren Buffett, and basically I'm going on a family vacation, but the first couple hours every morning, I'm going to be finishing this thing up. And, you know, everybody that writes a book on Buffett, they take a look, they basically look at everything he says, and then they formulate it into a book. I've been taking what I took all of their 13 F's and looked at all of their trading activity since 2000.
Wow.
And the trading activity is very different than what you think the Buffett story would be. And my point behind working that one in there is we you know, the Fed has what they're supposed to be doing and what they say their mandate is, and then what they're actually doing, and there's two completely different things going on there.
If you
did nothing but look at Buffett's trading, his average hold is about 3/4.
Really?
Yeah, and guess how many stocks he's gotten in and out of since 2000?
It would be 50 too many?
170.
Wow.
The thing is, the Fed, you know, they under previous chairman, I would go along with what you're saying, which is that they're saying they're supposed to be doing one thing, but they really have been doing something else. I don't think Powell is as much on board with worrying about the financial markets. He is doing what the Fed is supposed to be doing, and I think that's where he gets so much criticism.
I think he's. They never tried to attack this price level that's still gagging people. They never.
They raised rates.
Oh, a little bit.
I mean, they. And the trend, although I don't think it's behind us, you know, the trend is supposedly that prices are going up at a slower rate.
But that's...
I mean, we could spend an hour digging into why the numbers are BS, but we don't... let's not do that. But I feel like they did... I mean, they did what they were supposed to do with respect to inflation. I think they... were a little bit late, but when they realized they were a little bit late, they jumped on it and got. Considering everything else that's going on in the world that could stoke inflation, I think they've kept it somewhat under control.
I think Russell, I just was going through M2 yesterday. I'm trying to get the thing up here. At the end of the COVID stuff, they had done something absolutely unprecedented in our history. I'm sure. If I dig through Milton Friedman's papers, there'll be another country that did it. Well, the Weimar Republic probably did it. We increased the money supply 40% in 18 months. Or maybe it was mm-hmm. 20 months. That's never happened anywhere in any kind of a normal country. Even during wartime, we didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So we have this 40% bubble that pretty much everybody feels. They admit to 20%. So somewhere along the line, they put a gag on the CPI. I mean, I think all of us agree that the numbers don't match what's actually happening. So after that, if I get this thing up here, he somewhat aggressively, after COVID, started dropping the balance sheet down and then started actually decreasing M2, which is exactly what you and I would say, hey, you got to get some of this money out of here, right?
Yeah.
We're not talking about all 40, but you got to go the other way here a little bit. But you're way over the top on this stuff. All of a sudden, 6 months ago, they decided we're not doing that anymore. And we're going back up. Every single month is almost the exact same rate. It's 5.1% on an annual basis. That started in like June. It's like almost that they said, screw it. We're just going to let everybody have to deal with this bubble, and we're going to try things going forward. But even that is not normal, because if you're going forward, if you want your economy that's maybe not even growing at all, the highest you want money supply growing is maybe 2.5%, and we're over 5. So we're actually talking about more inflation. I mean, if I were to say to you, given our growth, real growth, if you inflate the money supply 5.2% a year, are you inflationary or deflationary? I'm going to say you're inflationary, which is what we're doing right now. So why all of a sudden the change, and what's the rationale behind it? They're just saying, oh, the economy, you guys are just going to have to deal with this 40%. How you do with it, I don't care. We're going on from here. It's one thing to do that and make absolutely sure that you have no inflation going forward and just hope people's, you know, salaries grow into it over the next 5 years, which actually might be, if you and I were in charge, we might actually say that that's our policy and we're going to try and do that. Hope we get away with it. But I don't think either one of us would begin to say we're going to start inflating again. I mean, what are we doing here? I don't get it at all.
No, I mean, well, the COVID situation was an unusual situation, and unfortunately, once you ramp things up, and we probably overly aggressively ramped things up during COVID.
Yeah,
we made a whole ton of mistakes during COVID. I saw some murder rate numbers that during the COVID crisis and then after, and it's. That's not going to count into that'll never show up in any statistics as to whether or not we did the right thing or the wrong thing around COVID. You're reacting to what's going on at the time. I understand inflating things up as much as they did. Hopefully, if you're sitting around and you're trying to get the balance sheet a bit under control, what you're hoping for is a period of rapid growth in the U.S. so that you can do that and it doesn't impact any other parts of the economy. Will we get a repeat of the 90s or something like that that helps us out? Probably at some point.
Do these people, you've, in addition to your sterling personality and your reports on dogs, you've brought not just yourself, but you've brought other people to the show, which has allowed us to understand a little bit more on what's going on in younger people's minds. And it's funny, the young lady, the last one you had on, not your daughter, who's the lady before her, the one from the business school? It's amazing what... And people do adapt. I mean, it's like a dog. Well, God, it's like, if a dog walks around on three legs, he adapts, right? Unless he's...
He figures it out.
He's not happy, but he figures it out.
No.
But the young lady who had nothing in her conversation, as bright as she was, or is, and as much as I'd love to have her back, never once did she mention herself owning a new car ever or owning a house ever. She never...
Yeah, she
wasn't even close to that. And we have made an incredible change in society. I'm not accusing Paul of being a bad actor. I wouldn't do that. He seems like a nice enough guy. Does he even know that, or are they so insulated they don't even know that?
I think they're insulated.
But this,
I really do. You know what, Chief? I wouldn't have the societal awareness that I do if I didn't do what I do professionally. And part of it is, I teach for I. It, it, explaining exactly what I do for the Kelley School of Business can be daunting. I teach 5 classes in Bloomington. I teach 3 in Indianapolis. And the Indianapolis campus is very different. It's a lot like University of Memphis, where I went. A lot of first-generation college students. A lot of students like the young lady, like people that I have brought on here from that school, that are at a different level than like my kids that have a lot of options around college and have a family that has the ability to pay for it. And being around those kids is really grounding and really good for me. It also gives me a little bit of a little bit of reminder of the Rhodes family roots as well. In fact, I had a first generation student who I had to have Mariana on sometimes. She's absolutely awesome. Who started taking classes at Ivy Tech when she was still in high school, finished college in 3 years, and now has a really good job in the accounting department at Cummins Engine.
Oh, cool! Good for her.
Her family immigrated from Mexico. She's like, she's first generation American as well. Being around people like that, you were talking about it really in the first hour. You're talking about when you were in Arizona at spring training, and you met a girl that was 24, still in college. Taking 9 hours and working her way through college. I took 6.5 years for undergrad because I worked full time and paid for it.
Why weren't you in the movie, Belushi?
I lived at home.
Belushi, why weren't you in the movie?
In what movie?
Was it Animal House? 7 years of college down the drain.
Oh, 8 years of college down the drain. Well, yeah, the big difference there is somebody was paying for his.
What was it? 0.000?
Everybody. Our 8 a.m. business classes at Memphis, which were really popular because a lot of people would take an 8 a.m. class and then get to work by 9:30 or so. There were also people that were getting off work. I'd have at least 3 or 4 people in their FedEx uniforms from working the overnight shift in my morning business classes.
Hey, just let me tell you.
That's the kind of people I grew up with. And being at the IU Indianapolis campus, I get to be around kids like that. And it's and it gives me more of a perception of reality. If teaching at University of Chicago, I'd probably be in the bubble and I wouldn't have nearly the realization about what's really going on out there that I do.
I would agree. Just to make give me 30 seconds here, Russell. What we've been talking about on the money supply stuff here, I have the chart in front of me, and this is probably different than most people think is happening, and that's kind of what we're talking about. But let me, for lack of a better term, COVID started February 2020, right? That's whenever they shut the bars down the day before St. Patrick's Day, which I thought was an abomination, but being Irish. The money supply was about $15.4 trillion, all right? From there, Trump's year and the first year of Biden, we reach a peak in March of 2022. So 2 years after that, we reach a peak of $21.7 trillion. So that's $6 trillion on top of 6.5 on top of 15. So what's that? 39% or something, right? I did the math. So all of a sudden we kind of kick COVID's ass or whatever. The people dead, but I'm not making light of that. So the Federal Reserve says, okay, look what we just did, for God's sake, and they start coming down. Now we come from 21.7 down to, in April of 2023, 27. So we're down 5%, maybe. And all of a sudden, I don't know, somebody decided, well, we're not doing that anymore. So from April of 2023, we go out here to say February 2024, and it's roughly the same amount. So we flattened out, which is, the policy you and I maybe have talked about. Maybe we can get away with just leaving the money supply flat, and as people become more productive and when wages go up, the average American will in fact be able to catch up over a four or 5 year period.
Exactly.
Okay, but somehow or another, in February 2024, and I don't know if it's the election, the politics, or whatever it is, we've decided we're going back up again. So now we're back up to 21,311, which is really very, very close to the tippy top. So we're marching forward on a very a mildly inflationary movement in the last since February. Now, my question is, why? We were going down, and then somebody said, well, got to be careful. That might take the market down and something. Actually, it did a little bit. Now, all of a sudden, we can't do that. Let's be flat for a while, and all of a sudden, we're actually pushing more money in again. These are incredibly major decisions, Russell, and I have this weird feeling that despite who we have in the Oval Office, somebody behind the scenes is pulling these chains. This is, I mean, if you said this to Trump or he said this to Biden, he wouldn't know what I was talking about. Yet, it's a clearly serious shift in how we all are going to live over the next 5 years. How many people aren't going to be able to afford it? I mean, we're talking about people who, in the last 20 years, have averaged 20%, 25% raise in the price of houses and cars and stuff are up 50 or 60 or double. I mean, we're not. Do we really want to do that to people? Do we want to become nobles and serfs? Maybe somebody does. I don't, but somebody does.
I don't think there's a division that's going that far out to see the division getting as bad as it's getting, and it's getting. It's almost it's like they've inflated things up, and it's almost like there are three divisions of folks now. The ridiculously, the ridiculously got a whole ton of FU money, and then a small percentage that's kind of getting by and doing fairly well, and then just about everybody else.
Well, I have somewhere.
And when the everybody else is 85% of people, God help the 15%.
Well, there's a piece of paper here that I will find out when I keep cleaning. Somebody, where the hell they got the stuff? I don't know, Russell, but there were different year chunks. The first one was like 1952 to 1974 or something. And they took it to every 20th percentile of people's wealth. And during that period of time, virtually every 20% slice of economy was moved up, say the number was 50% or something. Virtually every one of those groups was up the same amount. Matter of fact, the lower class was up a hair more than the higher class, upper class, which I'm going to say in all of history, have there been any more 25-year periods that were like that? I can't imagine there were.
Very doubtful.
So for the next however many years, all of a sudden you see the top two groups. But then the last 15, 20 years, you see the top 20% just race ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
But the weird part, there's a footnote to the chart. It said it's way worse than that. If you take the top 1% out of the top 20%, the other 19% aren't doing any better than anybody else.
Yeah. How do we get up to that top 1%, man?
I don't know. I mean, you see the difference in people's attitude toward money. And an example I use, and I don't know the lady. She could be terrific. The lady who was, isn't she the daughter of the guy? What was the guy's name that owned Las Vegas Sands? Is he the guy who built the?
It's not
Steve Wynn. Yeah, wasn't he the guy who built the Mirage? He was the guy who was going blind and then fortunately didn't.
I don't remember that part, but I think it was Steve Wynn because he's kind of a.
But his daughter sells. We're talking about billions of dollars worth of stock. So she sells some of it. Now, she doesn't pay any taxes, which is even more bizarre.
That's the way the inheritance works.
It is.
You know what? Actually, I have a real problem with the government taking a big chunk of everything that I built up in my life and make it very difficult for me to pass it on to Mike. Really.
I don't know. You know what? I would index it somehow.
Yeah. Know? But I just have a real problem. I mean, there's a happy medium in there.
Well, but the idea that if you're 90 years old and you've got 20,000 shares of Apple stock you bought at $6 and you sell it, okay, you have to pay capital gains the whole way through, which I think is pretty darn high. I think capital gains should be indexed. I'm agreeing with you on that. But if all of a sudden you go to the brokerage office, you're coming down to PTI to sell your stock, and somebody wipes you away in a car wreck, which I wouldn't want to see happen to you, even at age 90-something, and your lovely daughter comes in and says, I'll sell it. Guess what? I don't have to pay any taxes. Somehow, that's a little weird. I don't think you should have to pay the full amount, but I sure don't think she should pay zero either. You know, I mean,
exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah. I think there's a happy medium in there.
But I mean, she takes the $1 billion, and how many nights would you have to tend bar or do accounting work or manage people's money? How many hours would you have to put in to have $1 billion? This is funny money. It's like if you dropped a whole room full of $100 bills in front of me, what would I even do with them? You know, but I sit there and go, you know what? Why don't I take all these $100 bills? I don't even know how the hell I got them. I'll go over and buy half of a basketball team. it's totally trading money, right?
You could buy a college football team.
Yeah, you know what? Next week, well, actually, you're going to be gone for 2 weeks. When you come back, I want to hit you with the big question, my question of the week. If I walk, because I've been mentally and talking to the listeners, I want to come into your class. I want to do one thing. Do you guys even have a blackboard, or am I totally dating myself?
It's a whiteboard. You'll be very proud to know that I have a black chalkboard with regular old school chalk and eraser in my office.
Wow!
But you know, we use those whiteboards.
Do you make the student go out and have the bad student, instead of paddling them, you hit them out with the erasers to bang them against the wall to clean them?
Our finance is so technical, especially for undergrads, et cetera. I don't pick on them at all.
I know you don't.
I just don't. You know.
But what if I know what
you're saying.
What if I put up on the wall and I said, "Here's your first assignment for your 20-minute lecturer chief. Define profit in today's world. What do you think people would write?
The money I make.
What?
Money.
Indiana, Notre Dame, somebody's going to make a boatload of money in this game Friday night.
I don't know about that.
Well, okay, say they do.
You could find this out better than I could. I want to know who has control over the ticket sales and everything for the game. Is it Notre Dame or is it the college football playoff?
I'm going to...
And I'll tell you where this comes from. Is I worked for a double-A team a million years ago. Right? I was a bat boy for a double-A team. Tim Raines was on the team. One of the things that they did was our parents got season tickets. They drive us to the game, picks up from the game. And we made when we made the playoffs, the league controlled the tickets. And we actually had to buy the tickets for them to come to the playoff games. And my dad was so angry about spending the $4 for a double-A baseball ticket. He said, "Well, you're just not going to show up for work if I have to buy a ticket."
I'm gonna guess,
but I'm just wondering if the college football playoffs.
I think the answer is yes or maybe. I don't know what the demand is for these games at people's home stadiums.
It's huge for this.
No. What I'm talking about.
But there are other. Ones that it's not.
Let me finish. What I'm saying is, I don't think there's 4,000. I'll use the term poobahs, that like a Super Bowl game. I mean, or like a World Series game where they clean out the bottom 15 rows and they got to find seats for those people, and because Major League Baseball takes over the first 20 rows. I don't think that's happening, but I'm going to say that the Irish tickets are $250, $150, and $100, depending on where they are. So let's say it's average $150, 80,000 seats. So what the hell is that? What's 80,000 times 100 is 8 million. So the gate's going to be 12 million. My guess is Indiana's going to get 35, 40% of that, somewhere in there.
I think it's going to be that there's a completely different kind of split. And that it goes into a pool for all the college football playoff money that's distributed.
No, there's some advantage at hosting the home stadium. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, there's got to be. I mean, there's totally got to be. I mean, if anything, you can say you got to re-up your season tickets next year right now just to be in the lottery to get tickets.
Whatever.
And I know that from some of the involvement with the White Sox, that there's a dollar amount you can put on making the playoffs, and it's above what you get for the extra ticket sales because you can lock people in for the next year's ticket.
Well, what I'd like to see in some of these papers is, okay, let's say it's Commonwealth Edison. They're a utility. They're a monopoly. I'll bet somebody clever in class might say, gee, I looked at the top 100 executives versus the going rate for an executive in that size business. They all look to me like they're 35% overpaid. Well, I'm going to call that profit. When Northwestern University here in downtown Chicago, the hospitals, what is the guy on top of the totem pole? They're supposed to be nonprofit.
Yeah.
Plus, I think last year, didn't they make $50 million or $100 million or something?
Oh, I'm sure they. I know within the healthcare business space that they're a very profit run hospital group.
But when you say, the owners, people own shares, they're the part that goes over the fence last. So what's going to happen? Last question, because we're running over time. What happens if somebody, and I don't think Indiana's going to do it, and I don't know if the Irish will do it, but there are people who are willing, private equity people, or people that see, an opportunity, they'll be willing to buy 15% of Indiana's football program for a lot of money. Now, can a nonprofit group that doesn't pay any taxes, can I send that guy a dividend check?
No.
So next time you're on, let's kind of go through this, because I think these colleges are getting real close to where, hey, you guys aren't tax-free anymore. I think they're well over that line.
Yeah, but, here, do you know what? Ole Miss, decent SEC school, they lost their athletic department lost $8 million last year.
I'm going to say, bull.
I know, but still, they're not really turning a profit. And college football attendance is basically flat over the last 20 years. It's not a growth industry. More money's going to the players, less money's going to... I mean, why would you want to invest in a sport where your employees I would not want to invest in any company that my employees are a bunch of college football players. I'm sorry. I teach college kids, et cetera, but from a business standpoint, the lack of loyalty that you get out of them.
Well, that's when you got to change the contracts. We got a lot to talk about when you get back. You're out for a full 14 days or what?
Yeah, we're going to Amsterdam tomorrow, and I'm going to teach my kids about the world there, and then we're going to go to Paris for Christmas and New Year's.
It's too bad you don't.
It's fun because I always hate all of the, all of the gift buy-in and all that other kind of crap. It's kind of nice having adult children now and not having to do all the...
Boy, no kidding. You make sure that you are safe. And by the way, are you... the basketball was sponsored by Emirates Air. Are you guys going by Emirates Air?
No, we're not going by Emirates Air.
they look pretty nice the inside of those planes. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, they do. That's...
Anyway, you take care of yourself. Tell the whole family I said hello, and we'll see you. Three weeks. We'll see you. All right, buddy. Take care. SP futures. Right. What just happened here, Russell? SP futures are now flat. NASDAQ futures are down 30. So we've ducked back to break even here. Fed announcement in a bit. We'll talk all about it tomorrow morning.
That's all, folks.